From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. We're on the verge of a record-setting government shutdown. Find out what California might have to do without because of this federal stalemate. Plus, it's been chilly the last few days, and you may have been dealing with the chills, or maybe you feel like you're coming down with something. We'll hear some of our listeners' best cold comfort food suggestions sent in with an extra sprinkle of caring. It's all coming up on Take Two. Stay with us.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an evening master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Priority deadline to apply is January 21st at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. It's Friday. I know it's foggy, and I also know it's going to rain later today, but don't let that dampen your weekend. It just started, for goodness sakes. All right, coming up, if the fog and rain have you craving comfort foods, we've got some suggestions in just a few minutes.
And look, I've already dripped on myself. That's pretty much a sign of a good bowl of pho.
Yeah, we'll visit a restaurant that's been serving up pho for years to find out more about the popular Vietnamese soup. And whether you dine in or take out at a restaurant, we'll get some tipping advice from Consumer Reports. First, though, State of Affairs. That's our weekly peek at politics in the Golden State. And this week, federal funding for some major California projects could take a hit if President Trump follows through with his threat to declare a national emergency to build his border wall. Meanwhile, Governor Gavin Newsom's first budget includes a threat for cities that don't plan enough new housing. We'll get into that and more with Jack Pitney. He's the Roy P. Crocker Professor of Public Policy at Claremont McKenna College. Welcome back, Jack.
Good morning.
Also with us, Carla Marinucci, Senior Editor for Politico's California Playbook. Welcome back to you as well, Carla.
Good morning, A.
All right, Carla, let's start with you. And let's start with the latest effects of the partial government shutdown. Nationwide, some 800,000 federal workers will not receive paychecks today. There are also reports the Trump administration could be planning to declare a national emergency at the border, which could affect projects here in California. What's the latest on that?
Well, I mean, it gets down to, in California, more than 144,000 federal employees are here without a check today. That's more than any other state, A. And, you know, in addition to that, we've had these reports of California's national parks being trashed in the shutdown, parks like Point Reyes being overwhelmed with human feces and trash and porta potties, and Joshua Tree. You know, trees being vandalized and cut down by folks who want to do off-roading. But that news is just sort of minor compared to what's raising eyebrows today and concern among California House members, the news that President Trump has essentially been briefed on a plan that would divert about $2.4 billion, which is allocated to California projects from the Army Corps of Engineers, and maybe take a portion of about $14 billion of Army Corps funded that is targeted for wildfire relief and hurricane relief to build that 315 miles of wall along the U.S. border. And this is money that, you know, was originally meant to fund projects all over the country, including Puerto Rico, which is ravaged by hurricanes. But right now, you know, California and Puerto Rico haven't received that money. So the president, during that visit to Texas yesterday, was informed that if he makes an emergency declaration, he could take the money from those civil projects and build his border wall. So you're going to hear howling from members of Congress on this, who say it would be an abuse of power.
To know that two Joshua trees have been cut down, that hurts. I mean, it hurts to hear anyone that lives in California that someone could be that dumb.
And water, that is disturbing.
Yeah, water projects too, right, Carla? Water projects are also in the balance.
Yeah. I mean, you're talking about some major water projects in California that this money was allocated to. And at this point, I mean, you have people like John Garamendi, who was a deputy secretary of the Interior, saying that this is absolutely beyond the pale that the president would take money allocated to California projects like this and just pull the rug out from under them. But, you know, in one question, it's been raised that if he grabs that money, it does kind of take the rug out from under his demand for the $5.7 billion to build the wall. So This could be a little bit of a tricky act for President Trump.
Jack Pitney, this shutdown is reaching a historic point today. The last time a shutdown lasted this long, 1996. So what were the political effects of that shutdown?
That shutdown was very damaging to the Republicans in the House of Representatives. In fact, a famous book came out of that, Tell Newt to Shut Up. Newt Gingrich took a big political hit, and the Republicans saw that they were in serious danger of losing control of the House of Representatives. Finally, they surrendered to President Clinton and spent the rest of the political season making compromises with him. This time you have a president who is in less of a mood to compromise with Congress, and he is taking ownership of the government shutdown. So this is going to be very bad for Republicans.
Do you think we'll see similar backlash? Could it be more severe?
Possibly one, because Trump took ownership of the shutdown in his famous conversation with Chuck Schumer. But also you see some of the effects, the Joshua trees. The Coast Guard is not getting paid.
Wow.
Other military services are getting paid because they're the part of the Department of Defense. But Coast Guard is Department of Homeland Security, which is subject to the shutdown. So people in the Coast Guard are not getting paid. And in a very infamous incident this week, the Coast Guard put out a memo, which they took off the internet quickly. But they said, well, during the shutdown, you can have garage sales, you can make money by walking dogs, and, you know, and in the worst case, you can declare bankruptcy. Well, bankruptcy works for somebody like Trump. It doesn't work for somebody living paycheck to paycheck with the Coast Guard.
Well, Carlos, speaking of people that are living paycheck to paycheck, Gavin Newsom has stepped up to try and help some federal workers in the state. What's he trying to do?
Yeah, when he unveiled his budget yesterday in Sacramento, Newsom, in kind of a throwdown to Trump, actually, said to the thousands of federal workers in California who are furloughed, you know, come on down, come to the Employment Development Department. He wanted to get out the message and make sure that they knew they are going to be made quickly eligible for unemployment insurance, and he urged them to apply for benefits immediately. He said, we will get you covered. And I think that's a welcome message to a lot of those folks. But definitely, Newsom said he is very, very concerned about the economic impact that this is going to have in California with small businesses all the way down the line. The ripple effects of this shutdown still have not been measured.
Jack, we've got all this happening, plus the president's tweet this week saying he's ordering FEMA to stop giving California money to help it cope with wildfires. That's earned him criticism of even Republicans here in the state. Taking the long view on this, could this all seriously hurt Republican chances of making a political comeback here in California?
Yeah, those chances were not very robust to begin with in the wake of the 2018 election. And this is going to hurt even more. Wildfires don't know party. I remember the station fire that came to our neighborhood. In fact, a local television station set up on the apron of our driveway to get dramatic footage of the flames. So that affects Republicans as well as Democrats. And again, there's no political justification for this, no policy justification for this. And to put it bluntly, the naked cruelty of that tweet was stunning. Some Republicans are trying to distance themselves from it, but they're handcuffed to Donald Trump politically.
I was going to ask, distance themselves or break ranks? They're kind of two different things.
Yeah, they're distancing themselves. They're saying, well, let's think about this. But ultimately, this is the Trump party, and the reaction to Trump is going to hurt the Republicans up and down the ballot.
Talking State of Affairs with Jack Pitney, Roy P. Crocker, Professor of Politics at Claremont McKenna College, Carla Marinucci, Senior Editor for Politico's California Playbook. Now, Carla, with everything going on, it's almost easy to forget that California got a new governor this week, and that governor, Gavin Newsom, unveiled a $209 billion budget yesterday. What does his budget tell you about his priorities?
You know, I think the real message of his priorities came in his inauguration, where his two-year-old son, Dutch, basically stole the show and toddled onto the stage, and Newsom, in the middle of his inaugural speech, scooped the kid up and just kept going. Basically, it was an exact illustration of what the budget that he unveiled yesterday sort of said, that his administration's efforts are going to be to push for policies that benefit California's families and kids. And, I mean, he almost immediately with that inauguration, unveiled an unprecedented proposal to provide families with 6 months of paid parental leave. That is a boost from 6 weeks. And he set aside almost $2 billion to early childhood education while also offering community college students 2 years of free community college, and that's going to cost about $40 million. I mean, what we saw here was, Newsom is clearly enjoying the tailwinds of this massive surplus and, you know, Democratic supermajorities in both houses. But he really did set out his priorities here, and I think he looked to draw a direct contract with Washington and the Trump administration by introducing another package of proposals for progressive health care policies, and that includes, you know, increased affordability for consumers through Obamacare plans, extended coverage to undocumented youth. That's a little bit controversial. And to use the state's power to leverage lower drug prices. So all of this got him good reviews in places like the Washington Times, basically. Washington Post, I should say.
That's a different place altogether.
The Washington Times would have been a real headline. But the Washington Post basically said this is what other states should be doing. So he got good, really good reviews from a lot of Republican legislators I talked to up there yesterday.
Jack, what caught your eye about his budget?
Well, the key word is parenthood. He's acting like a good parent. As Carla pointed out, he's setting aside money for things like community colleges, education, early childhood education. But in addition to that, he's also setting aside money for budget stability, $13.6 billion for things like debt repayment, rainy day funds, reduction of unfunded pension liabilities. This is all to put the state on a good fiscal footing. And it's a sign that, like a good parent, he's thinking about the stability of the House.
Now, Carla, it wasn't all just spend, spend, spend. There was also a threat of maybe not spending in certain places if certain cities don't improve housing. What was that about?
Yeah, that's right. One of Newsom's initiatives and some of the things he said repeatedly in the campaign trail is California's housing has got to be addressed, the housing prices. It is one of the reasons why California's poverty level is the highest in the U.S. And basically he said, look, I'm going to watch if if local cities and local communities don't meet housing goals, they may have to suffer and maybe not get some of that gas tax funding. He said, why should they get transit money when they're not meeting the housing goals? That is a kind of a radical idea, but it's something he said needs to be done. And it's, I think, something that is going to create controversy in a lot of communities. He said he wants, for instance, Silicon Valley, I expect you to step up and begin creating the housing that your workers need. This is a message we haven't heard before in that strong terms. But yesterday, that was Newsom's message. Housing is going to be his main priority. And for homelessness, he's going to spend $500 million on emergency housing, emergency facilities for the estimated 137,000 people who are out there on the streets here in California.
And one of the things that I saw that Eric Garcetti seemed very happy by those two points. He seemed willing, at least on the surface, to take up that challenge. So we'll see how that works out here in Los Angeles. Carla, former Governor Jerry Brown has long warned of an impending recession. Do you think Gavin Newsom is upholding Brown's tradition of saving for the future? Because I remember Jerry Brown was a little worried that there would be a lot of spending going on.
No, I think, and that is one of the landmarks of the Newsom budget. He is going to, you know, use some of the estimated $21.4 billion surplus to lay the groundwork for future expansion. But he said he's going to pay off a lot of those debts. He's going to reverse borrowing gimmicks that go back as far as, you know, the Arnold Schwarzenegger era. And he's taking a page from the famous cheapskate Governor Jerry Brown, saying that discipline is going to be what he's all about. He's going to pay down some of those unfunded pensions. That made a lot of Republicans up there in Sacramento very happy. So that was a big message from his budget rollout yesterday, that more than $13 billion will be used for what he called budget resiliency, fixing those issues before he begins on a spending spree.
Jack, one last question for you before we let you guys go. Predictions for how this shutdown will play out. President Trump is in deep at this point. Even we talked to Katie Hill yesterday. She thinks he has no other way to go, really, at this point. Where does the president go from here?
One theory is that he's going to issue the emergency declaration, declare victory, and reopen the government. Meanwhile, the courts will hold up the emergency declaration. And so we end up with the government open, but we don't end up with a wall. But whatever the courts rule, that's problematic. If the courts strike it down, that sets a precedent that could be troublesome for the next president in case there's a real emergency for which the president really does need flexibility. As a former White House counsel said it, if you litigate something and you lose it, you lost it, and Trump would lose it for the next president. But if he wins, that sets another precedent of expanding presidential power. And I don't think conservatives would like it if President Kamala Harris used emergency power for global warming.
Jack Pitney is the Roy P. Crocker Professor of Politics at Claremont McKenna College. Carla Marinucci, Senior Editor for Politico's California Playbook. Jack, Carla, have a great weekend, you two.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. All right, sometimes when there's a labor dispute, one of the most important battlegrounds turns out to be the court of public opinion. Tone in the terms used goes a long way to swing which side appears right and then which side appears to be wrong. And then when support starts to pick a side, your best intentions don't look very good for everyone else. That is playing out right here in Los Angeles. We'll tell you more when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Southern California, the home of Hollywood, Dodgers, Disneyland. Sometimes it feels like paradise. But any second now, that could change. Because a big earthquake is coming.
This will happen. There's no likelihood of it not happening. We are not stopping plate tectonics.
When the earthquake hits, our world will be shaken. So what can you do to prepare? I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Back now, Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. A teacher strike is still looming. It's now been called for Monday the 14th, unless an agreement is reached between the LA Unified School District and the union representing its educators, United Teachers Los Angeles. The two sides are meeting again later today. KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes is here to catch us up with the latest. Hello, Kyle.
Hi, A.
All right. Money at the center of these negotiations. Governor Gavin Newsom gave us a little glimmer of hope yesterday when he announced more funding for public education in the state. Tell us what the governor said and how that might factor into today's talks.
Well, there was a lot of celebration after the governor's budget proposal came out. It included almost $3 billion in new ongoing funding for K through 12 education, more than $2 billion on the way to $3 billion for the local control funding formula, both benefiting public schools. And also on top of that, he also announced a one-time $3 billion payment, proposed, I should say. This is all a proposal, but a $3 billion one-time payment to pay down state pensions that are, you know, two pensions that are huge for LAUSD. And so it was sort of, you know, whether this was directly aimed at helping LAUSD, I mean, it's obviously helping school districts all over the place if this goes through. But the superintendent, Austin Buettner, in LAUSD came away and said, all right, now the governor gave us, you know, essentially we're due for a windfall, and not just in one-time funds, but in potential ongoing revenue. So we're going to come back tomorrow. We're going to bring back a new package for the union, and maybe we'll see if we can meet some of their demands. So the governor's budget proposal really, it has the potential to be a game changer at this point. It's another sort of ray of hope in this process.
Any sense, Kyle, if everything you just mentioned will maybe cause some movement here between the two sides and their major sticking points?
Well, so you just add up those numbers that I mentioned about what the governor's proposal includes, and I've had some sources give me back of the napkin math that says that adds up to, you know, somewhere in, it's a couple hundred million dollars for LAUSD, and it could be, you know, I mean, I've heard the number $400 million, and I wouldn't, you know, I don't know how deeply checked that is. It's sort of back of the napkin math about how much that the budget proposal includes. Regardless, it's a lot of money in the context of these negotiations. When you consider that the district continues to criticize the union's demands on a very big sticking point like class sizes, saying that the union's demands to lower class sizes would cost something like $500 million, and they'd love to do it. They just can't afford it. Well, now this money comes in from the governor. It's real ongoing revenues. It's added to the floor of funding. It's not funding that's easily taken away. It's not a one-time infusion of cash, which has sort of been the concern of county regulators and of Austin Buettner, that this would all get paid for out of reserves, and there's only so much reserves we have to spend. This sort of gets around that problem if it's money that comes through. And so the possibility that it makes it easier to cut a deal around a sticking point like class size, depends on what the district brings to the table. They say they're bringing a new offer to the table today, but it might make things easier.
When will we know about what happens today?
Well, so they're meeting today at 1 o'clock. The habit that we've had in the two negotiation sessions recently has been to have a 5 o'clock press conference. And so just watch the timing on that. I mean, like, if it's a 5 o'clock press conference, my odds are that they had a fruitful negotiation session. Maybe they'll continue to talk through the weekend. Mm-hmm. If they go late, that might be a really good sign. That might mean that they're making a lot of progress. On the other hand, if they go in at one and the union's like, this is not a really good new proposal, is this what you really expect us to do with all this new money? That could be a bad sign. And, the two sides have said that they're going to talk through the weekend. So today isn't make or break, but yeah. Watch that, the relative distance of the 5 o'clock press conference. Whether or not it's a 5 o'clock press conference earlier or later, it's going to tell you a lot.
All right, Kyle Stokes, KPCC's education reporter. Kyle, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Continuing with LAUSD, over the last few weeks, we've heard from various stakeholders, district officials, union officials, and a lot of parents who share this sentiment.
Yes, we support the teachers.
We are on the side of the teachers.
Our teachers have 100% of my support.
What we're hearing in Los Angeles today marks a shift in the national sentiment just 10 years ago, when education reformers were making headlines talking about sweeping out the, quote, bad teachers. Remember Michelle Rhee, Washington, D.C.'s chancellor of schools on the cover of Time magazine, who posed with that broom? Well, to talk about this change in attitude toward teachers, we've reached out to John Rogers, professor of education at UCLA. Thanks for coming on the show.
Good morning, A.
Now, if we go by what parents have told us in recent weeks, it seems that teachers, and therefore the union, are winning the public opinion war here. Do you see this as a different narrative than we've had or seen in the past?
I think nationally, we've seen over the last few years, and particularly in the last year, the general public has had a more favorable opinion of teachers, and to some extent of teachers' unions as well.
Why do you think that? What have you seen?
Well, one of the reasons why there's been a real shift this last year has been the so-called Red for Ed movement, the mobilization in red states, West Virginia, Kentucky, Oklahoma, Arizona, of teachers making demands for more funding for education and making the case that it's critically important to invest in public schools as critical democratic institutions that serve everyone well.
And what has that done, though, specifically, John, to get more people maybe understanding or maybe even taking up teacher sides in these kinds of disputes?
I think that the general public in those states, and then as people in other states watch those mobilizations, I think the general public came to view teachers as, in effect, guardians of democracy, as actors who were seeking to promote the well-being of the general public, because in each of those mobilizations, there was a real effort to articulate the ways that public education and quality public education serves everyone well.
So it became a different kind of labor issue then, John, not just simply about money.
I think that's exactly right. And I also think that those mobilizations coming in this period of Donald Trump's presidency were seen by some as efforts to shore up democratic institutions during a period when democracy is under strain, when certain political actors are calling into question our core democratic institutions.
Talking to John Rogers, professor of education at UCLA, who mentioned Michelle Rhee and Michelle Rhee-type reformers of a decade ago. What was happening in education back then that gave rise to that movement?
Sure. If we recall, about 10 years ago, the Great Recession was emerging. And with the Great Recession, we saw extraordinary pressures on state budgets and then district-level budgets because of less tax revenues flowing in. And in some cases, this led districts to think about the need to reduce their number of employees. And that then raised questions about which teachers would be laid off. That created a backlash within parts of the public who were concerned that some of their favorite teachers were being laid off. And I think that created some ill will or at least some tension in relationship to teachers' unions.
And teachers getting laid off, one thing leads to another. That means the classroom size is going to be a lot bigger and kids won't get as much individual attention as maybe they did just before.
Exactly. And I think one of the things that we've seen in the last few years as the budgets of states and districts have been replenished is that the demand for teachers has begun to rise. So rather than a public problem being perceived as the need to identify teachers to let go, now we face teacher shortages around the country in California and in Los Angeles.
In these high-profile teacher strikes that we've seen in recent years, West Virginia, Kentucky, Arizona, Oklahoma, you mentioned some of these red states. In those strikes, did the teachers get what they wanted?
In many of those instances, the teachers were able to, with the general public support, persuade states to increase overall funding for education, which meant increasing teacher salaries and in some cases meant lowering class sizes and improving overall conditions in the schools.
Well, just the terms, too. I mean, you even mentioned cost control, one argument for LAUSD, and then you've got UTLA's argument with smaller classrooms. One sounds cold and financial, and the other sounds a lot warmer, and maybe you got a different feeling from both terminologies.
I think that's right, A, and to some extent, these are two different approaches to dealing with what both sides agree are some fiscal problems that exist in the district. Both sides recognize that there's been declining enrollment in the last few years in Los Angeles Unified. The district's position has been that, well, we need to deal with that declining enrollment and loss of funding by containing costs. The union says, rather than cut costs, we need to grow our programs so that we ensure that people want to stay in district public schools, and in fact that community members want to come back to those schools. So it's a two different approaches to the same problem.
John, in the end, how much does it matter who's winning the court of public opinion?
I think it matters hugely. The degree to which the general public aligns themselves with one side or another likely will determine which side concedes in the next few days, and hopefully we'll come to a resolution. And part of moving forward after the resolution will be for each side to be able to demonstrate how what was agreed to fits with their story of what sort of education Los Angeles should have in the future.
UCLA education professor John Rogers. John, thanks a lot.
Thank you, A. I appreciate it.
You may have noticed it's been chilly the last few days, and maybe you have been dealing with the chills yourself, or maybe you really, really think you're coming down with something. Well, coming up, we'll hear some of our listeners' best cold comfort food suggestions, all sent in with an extra dash of love and an extra sprinkle of caring. That's coming up when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Their flexible evening format has locations in West LA, Encino, and Irvine, and is designed for working professionals preparing graduates for licensure in both marriage and family therapy and professional clinical counseling. Classes start September. Apply by January 21st to be considered for a $4,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. It's going to get chilly this weekend. Also looks like a lot of rain. That's the perfect weather for a piping hot bowl of soup, just like pho. Now, if you're unfamiliar, pho is a Vietnamese broth with rice noodles, some herbs, and usually beef. If you're craving a bowl, luckily you can find it pretty much in almost every single LA neighborhood these days. So we decided to go old school for our pho. Golden Deli in Temple City. LAS food editor Alina Shatkin joined us and explained why this spot is so special.
I chose Golden Deli because Golden Deli, which now has two locations, is one of the oldest pho restaurants here in the San Gabriel Valley. The original location in San Gabriel has been around since 1981. So it's just such a classic, and they do a really good job with beef pho, and they do a great job with the egg rolls. So you got two awesome things to try here.
You know, every so often there's always some kind of food that explodes in popularity all over the country. And pho in the last 5 or 10 years is probably one of those that's at the top of the list. But Elena, I mean, especially right here in Southern California, in the LA area, and where we're at right here in the San Gabriel Valley, I mean, this is just part of normal daily cuisine.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the soup is just wonderful and so nourishing, and you will find pho pretty much anywhere at this point in the United States, but especially here in Southern California, especially down in Orange County and Westminster, Garden Grove, that area. We have probably one of the largest expat Vietnamese communities anywhere in the world. So, of course, you're going to find tons of great pho places all throughout Southern California and here in the San Gabriel Valley, where there are a lot of Vietnamese Americans living here.
All right, so what do we got in front of us?
Okay, in front of us here, we have a bowl of the pho gao, which is the chicken pho. And over here, we have two bowls of the beef pho. You've got the one with the just the brisket and the ribeye. And you can see that it's thinly sliced and it's partially been cooked from being in the broth. And then my bowl, basically the same soup as yours, except that I also have tendon and tripe. So if you like those sorts of things, the number one is the one to get.
I might not share that one.
Fair enough. Then we've got a whole plate of garnishes.
And this goes in the pho, right?
Yeah, if you wanted to. You could eat it totally plain like this. You don't have to garnish it. Just depends on what you like. We've got a plate here. It's got Thai basil, cilantro, bean sprouts, sliced raw jalapenos, and then of course you've got you've got all the various sauces and garnishes, the chili sauces, the hoisin, etc.
You know what I've always enjoyed about pho is that it's a very flexible meal. So you could have the meat that's in it. You can have the noodles. You can mix them both together. You can just have the soup. You can eat them all if you want to, if your stomach has a room to hold all that. But it can really be a million kind of different meals all in one.
Yeah. And look, I've already dripped on myself. That's pretty much the sign of a good bowl of pho.
Hi, my name's Guido. And I'm the manager at Golden Deli. This location's been open for just about 8 years. February would be 8 years exact.
Okay. And the original location, though, in San Gabriel.
Oh, that one's, yeah. It's going on just about, 37 years? 38 years? 1981, pretty much, yeah.
37 years. So what do you attribute to a restaurant in Los Angeles lasting 37 years?
I guess we just have the right recipes that everybody loves, so we just continue that. We haven't really changed much.
This is the pho doc viet, is that correct?
That's right.
Okay, I want to make sure. I know I'm mispronouncing pretty badly.
No, that's good.
Tell me, I know a little bit how it's made, but maybe you could just tell our listeners a little bit about how the broth for pho doc viet is made.
It's a long process. We cook it for about maybe 6-7 hours, and you know, there's loads of beef bones, yellow onions, and all the other, you know, necessary ingredients. But yeah, it takes a little while to cook.
And your secret combo of spices and...
Oh, yes, of course, yeah.
I think would be the sort of great secret.
It's a secret, so, you know, we don't want to expose that.
Is there anything, though, when it comes to pho, that if you were to see it somewhere else, you would say, no, that's not authentic. That's not how it's supposed to be.
There's different types of pho in different regions, and, you know, the taste will vary from here and there. In Vietnam, I mean. So over here, it's going to be the same thing. Everybody has their own family recipe, and it'll change from town to town. So I can't really say that it's more authentic here or more authentic down the street or wherever. Everybody has their own recipe, but we find that this has worked for us pretty well.
So I'm curious, if you were to get a bowl of pho in front of you, a bowl of the pho bok, how would you dress it?
With our broth and our soup, I don't think we really need to add that much to it. All I would put in is the basil, of course, bean sprouts, some chili, fresh jalapenos, and I I would put a little bit of the chili oil. I find that really good. I don't really need anything else besides that. I mean, with hoisin sauce and sriracha, if anything, I'll put that on the side, but I'll never put it in the soup.
Really? Yeah. I put that in my soup. That's okay. There's I did it completely wrong.
Well,
this is the thing, though, I'm telling you. Like, yeah. There's not really a wrong way, right?
There isn't, but what I would recommend people do is just try the broth first before you add anything to it to see if you need to adjust flavor here and there. Maybe you might like it more salty, or you know, you want to add pepper or something like that, you know.
Well, Hui Do, manager at Golden Deli, thanks for letting us hang out here.
Come by anytime.
All right, Elena, there's a lot of pho places all over the L.A. area. How can we find some of the better ones?
Well, we have a great list on laist.com, laist.com, and I can recommend a few for you if
sure,
you'd like.
Sure, yeah.
So out here in the San Gabriel Valley, aside from Golden Deli, we've got Pho Filet 2 in Rosemead, and of course the original Pho Filet. If you are in downtown L.A., go to Chinatown for Pho 87. It's a good place. Blossom has several locations. I've got one in downtown, one in Chinatown, another in Silver Lake, and one in Santa Monica. On the west side, I'm a really big fan of Forage, spelled P-H-O-R-A-G-E. And there are plenty of other places, and you'll find them all on the list at LAist.
All right, Elena, thanks for another food adventure.
You're welcome. It's been fun.
Cold, wet weather doesn't just make you want to snuggle up with a bowl of pho. It also makes a lot of us sick. It's cold season here at KPCC, so that got us wondering, what food do you turn to when your throat is scratchy and your nose is stuffed? Take Two listeners sent us their favorite cold comfort foods, and surprise, pho made an appearance. Well, a form of it, anyway.
Hi, my name is Yvonne Sanders, and my favorite comfort food when I have a cold is my faux pho. And yes, that is spelled F-A-U-X-P-H-O. I call it that since I don't take all day to make it, just about 2 hours, plus the prep time, of course. I take leftover beef bones from a roast, along with a big hunk of ginger, a head of garlic, and a few whole onions, and then I toss them with some olive oil, salt and pepper, and throw them into a 400-degree oven and let that roast for about a half an hour. Then I add all of that to a big pot with some low-sodium beef or chicken broth and some fish sauce. Then I put it all together in a huge bowl, and then I just slurp away. Every spoonful reminds me of my grandma and mom and how much I've learned from them and how much I miss them both. That's why I make it. The smells, the tastes, the memories, all of mom's, but mostly grandma's cooking. And soul is right there on my spoon.
Hi, my name is Jenny Cho, and when I have a cold, I really like to eat chuk. Chuk is a Korean rice porridge. It's actually popular in a lot of Asian countries, and it's also known as congee. And this is my favorite dish to eat when I have a cold, because when you have a cold, you don't really have a great sense of appetite, and rice porridge is very simple. It's almost bland, some might say, but actually it's that simplicity that makes it really easy on the stomach, and it's just a really great comfort food when you're really experiencing a lot of those cold symptoms. It always reminds me of my home and my mom, because she always used to make juk for me when I was sick. So it kind of has a special place for me, and that's my cold comfort food.
This is Kathy Chavez-Morris from San Gabriel. My favorite go-to comfort food when I am sick is a Mexican favorite called caldo de res. It's basically a beef soup that has loads of vegetables like zucchini and cabbage and carrots and these lovely beef chunks that just in flavor and infuse the soup so well along with the veggies. In order to clean out your sinuses, though, you need to have copious amounts of red chili flakes with it. It's the only way to eat it. It is the go-to comfort food for every Hispanic household. I'm now a vegetarian, but even when I get sick, I still will drink the broth from Caldo de Res because it is just comfort food for the soul and guaranteed to pick me up and get me back to work.
You can check out all those suggestions and more on our Facebook. We're at Take Two Show. All right, used to be you'd only expect to tip someone when you went to get something to sit down at a restaurant or a bar. Nowadays, though, that circle has widened because now there's coffee shops, hotel housekeepers, even doctor's offices. Then how much is an appropriate tip for the particular service provided? That equation is evolving, too. Coming up, taking a page from Dua Lipa, I got new rules on tipping. That's ahead when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. If you've been in an Uber or eaten at a restaurant, the experience usually ends the same way, with a tip, or at least the expectation that you'll give one. There are more situations today where people are expected to tip than just 2 years ago, according to a new survey from Consumer Reports. For more details on how much to tip and in what circumstances, we have Toby Stanger. She's senior editor for Consumer Reports' Money Team. Toby, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Toby, why has it gotten so confusing, this whole idea of tipping?
Well, you know, tipping has been around for more than a century in the U.S. It came over from Europe, and the Europeans have kind of got rid of it. But we have taken it and run with it. So there are so many services now that expect you or hope that you're going to tip. And, you know, you get the tip jars at Starbucks, and you get the college fund jars at the pizzeria, and so that adds to all the confusion about what to tip. Before, it used to just be restaurants and so forth, and now there's so many more people you're supposed to tip.
Like which kinds of people, what kind of services expect tipping now that maybe didn't a few years ago?
Well, even Uber started as a service that did not require a tip, and now they're encouraging you to tip to show your appreciation for what they call excellent service.
Give us some more, because this is I love this stuff, because that's the thing. You never know how these rules change over time.
Yeah, well, you may have been at a takeout place like Starbucks, for example, where they turn around the screen and ask if you want to leave a tip. And sometimes those tips start at 18% and go up.
Let me ask you about this. Is a good way to start is to maybe have a starting point? In other words, like say 20% is where I start before this, say, meal begins, and it'll go up and down depending on how it goes.
Yeah, so Consumer Reports has suggested that you start with 15 to 20% of the pre-tax total of the bill. And that includes alcohol, by the way. So that's an easy way to consider it.
Talking to Toby Stanger, she's senior editor for Consumer Reports' Money Team. We're talking all about tipping. Now, the Consumer Reports story on tipping found that almost half of Americans said they favor a system to do away with tipping and instead charge prices that reflect the true cost of paying workers a living wage. How likely is that, Toby?
Well, from our research, it looks like it's an upward battle for that kind of a system. But in this country, there have been efforts by individual restaurant chains or restaurants or even by cities, and there's been not a lot of interest, not only by the public, but by the servers themselves. It's complicated.
Yeah, it definitely is. So when it comes to restaurants, and say you're picking up food, you're not eating the food in the restaurant, it's a takeout service, you're picking up an order, how much should a person tip for that?
Yeah, again, it depends. We say in Consumer Reports that the barista, you can give them, you know, from $1 to $3. If it's a food delivery person, 20% of the entire bill, or $3 to $5, whichever is higher. We don't go into specifics about other kinds of takeout, but you could probably base it on the barista tip.
Now, your research, Toby, found something pretty interesting about the difference between men and women when it comes to tipping. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, women are more likely than men to always tip when dining at a sit-down restaurant. 91% of the women that Consumer Reports surveyed said that they do so, whereas 80% of men said that. And this is a nationally representative sample of about 1,000 adults. Women also were more likely to tip waitstaff at 20% or higher. About 32% of women said they did that, 27% of men.
What about when you're staying at a hotel and there's this issue of whether you should tip the person taking care of the room?
Yeah, so this is something I learned that I wasn't even aware of, but it's recommended that you tip every day a little bit if you're staying more than one day, because it may be a different housekeeper going to clean up your room from day to day. And we recommend from $3 to $5 a day. So that is going to increase the price of staying at a hotel.
I can already imagine someone saying, wait a second, cleaning that room is what they're being paid to do. Why do they need a tip for that?
Well, there are a lot of jobs that really don't pay very much. And this is the main problem with tipping, is that it is often available for workers to raise their pay to minimum wage or just above minimum wage. And this is what the big concern is of people who want to do away with tipping, because tip may not get to who it's supposed to get to. Also, tipping is not really fair. People tend to tip more, research has found. They tend to tip slim women, blonde women, women in general. They don't tip servers of color as often. So there can be inequities that happen all the way down the line, which is what no tipping programs are intended to address. But whether those will get adopted is another story.
All right. Toby Stanger is Consumer Reports senior editor for Money. She's been speaking with us about the tipping etiquette as reported in the magazine's February issue. Toby, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Finally, the weekend's around the corner, and we're here to help. We've got Christine Ziemba from LASTA here in studio. So if you have major FOMO, fear missing out, then get to one of these fun events this weekend. Christine, what do you have for us first?
Here's a great option if you've been cooped up in the office all week. The Griffith Park Hiking Group holds its first night hike of the year tonight from 7 to 9 p.m. This intermediate hike is about 4 miles long, so bring a warm jacket, water, and appropriate hiking shoes. Doggies are welcome, but they must be on leash at all times. So meet up at parking lot number 2 at Griffith Park near the merry-go-round, and the event is completely free.
I love me some Griffith Park. The thing is, though, if I do a hike at Griffith Park, Christine, I'm going to get hungry. So where can I get some food?
So if you're into burgers, beer, and horse racing,
yes, yes, and yes,
then you can indulge in all three at Santa Anita Park on Saturday from 11 to 4. The Burger and Brewfest tickets include 4 sliders from some of SoCal's best burger joints and 8 3-ounce craft beer tastings. You also get clubhouse admission and a $5 betting voucher to pick your long shots. Tickets are $45.
All right. Sounds cool. What else you got?
On Sunday, there's a mobile museum fair at the Central Library in downtown L.A. From 1 to 5 p.m., families can explore more than 2 dozen bookmobiles, libraries, and museums on wheels. Participating organizations include the California Sneaker Museum, Self-Help Graphics and Art, Libros Schmibros, and the Candy Wrapper Museum. Even the Aquarium of the Pacific is bringing a mobile tide pool, allowing visitors to touch sea stars and sharks. The event is completely free, too. Now, A, are you up for something a little offbeat?
There is an A in offbeat. I'm all offbeat. Go ahead. What is it?
I'm talking about the No Pants Metro Ride. Yes, you heard me correctly. Ride the rails trouserless, just for fun, on Sunday from 1 to 3 p.m. And if you can do so keeping a straight face, then even better. Join hundreds of other participants at one of 6 meeting places, including the North Hollywood, Culver City, and Willowbrook Rosa Park stations. Meet your ride captains at 1 p.m. and don't forget Metro Fare, which runs $7 to $9 for a day pass.
All right, that's LAS Christine Ziemba, and there's so much more to do than just that. You can find a whole list of events on LAIST.com. That's LAIST.com. Christine, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
All right, that's going to do it for Take Two. We'll be back Monday morning at 9. You can find us on Twitter at Take Two. That's at Take Two. You can find me Twitter and Instagram at AMartinezLA. Same address for both social media spots. All right, Air Talk with Larry Mantle is coming up next. Larry, we've got the potential strike of the teachers looming over us this weekend. You're going to hear from some folks all Friday long.
Yeah, if there is a strike on Monday, it's obviously going to be chaotic on the first day. I think everybody agrees, regardless if that happens. We're going to open up the phones for parents. How are you planning for a potential strike if you have kids at an LA Unified campus? Would you cross the picket line? Do you even have another option than taking your child to school on Monday morning? So we're going to take that on right out of the opening. And then Film Week, of course, coming up at 11 o'clock. We got a number of big films talking about this week.
Yeah, of all weekends to have Kevin Hart have a movie out this weekend, right? I mean, could be a good thing, could be a bad thing.
Well, he's sure been everywhere promoting it.
Sure he has. All right, Air Talk with Larry Mantle coming up at 10. Thanks, Larry.
Thanks, A.